Jordan Coolwater is a young American Indian living with his grandparents on Creek Indian land. And he's the protagonist in a new collection of short stories. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The stories in Cheyenne Madonna follow Jordan Coolwater from youth to adulthood and paint portraits of the people around him. This is Eddie Chukalot's first book. He's a student at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop and a recipient of the O. Henry Prize. I'll talk with him about his work, and we'll talk about the literature of American Indians, from the lost texts of the Mayans to the bestsellers of today. Philip Round is professor of English and American Indian and Native Studies at the University of Iowa, and James Kopic is a poet, and he teaches at the Department of English and American Indian Studies program at Iowa State University. Please join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Eddie Chukalate is the author of a new collection of short stories called Cheyenne Madonna. The book is new, but one of the stories in it won a Penn O. Henry Prize in 2007. Right now, Chukalate is a student at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. And Eddie, these stories in the book follow Jordan Coolwater through much of his life. Tell me about Jordan as we first see him.
When you first see him, he's a youngster in about fifth or sixth grade, living with his grandparents in the summer in a rural setting outside of Muskogee, Oklahoma.
And Jordan Coolwater is three-quarters American Indian?
The book just describes him as Creek and Cherokee Indian.
I'd love to have you read something from one of the stories to give us a flavor for the book. And this is from a story that partway through the book called A Famous American Indian Artist.
That's called A Famous Indian Artist.
All right.
This is the third story in here. Okay. I'll just read the first section. My uncle is the best Indian artist in the state of Oklahoma, more famous than I'll ever be, has flown around the world and visited many countries, namely Spain, knows intimately the best restaurants and private clubs in the biggest cities, and drinks and carouses with well-known actors and entertainers, Willie Nelson and Kris Kristofferson among them. He sat across from me at the small kitchen table, tapping cigar ashes on the floor, and turning up the bottom of a big smoke-green wine bottle. He drank, grimaced, continued his monologue. Johnson L. Freebird's my name. Wild women and booze is my game, he blurted, then stomped the linoleum with a shiny leather boot. Since he was my uncle, I obviously knew his name, but until then did not exactly know what was his game. Wild women and booze, he snorted again nostalgically. With a flick of his tongue, he puffed a cloudy gray smoke ring. It lingered perfectly in front of his sweaty face, and he blew a smaller one into that, and yet a smaller one into that. He caught and held my eye to make sure I had seen. I had seen all right. I had seen and heard that and a lot more in the hour or so since he had walked in. I was sitting alone, doodling in my sketch pad at the kitchen table, when a silver flash caught my attention outside the window. Incredibly, an 18-wheel semi-truck had just stopped in front of the house. Incredible because we lived in a small Indian housing project on a small street in a tiny town in eastern Oklahoma. The interstate was 30 miles away. It looked absurd, this glittering, rumbling truck which blocked the sun and dwarfed the newly planted trees of our neighborhood. I thought the driver may have been lost and was about to go out to ask when a cowboy boot flew out the passenger's window. There was a pause, then another boot rolled out like a chopper blade. Then came a grocery sack with jeans and T-shirts spilling out. The window went up, the door swung open, and someone jumped to the ground, clutching brown paper sacks in each hand. We stared at each other through the glass of the door. He stood in the grass in white sock feet, blue jeans, and a plain red T-shirt, which was tucked in tightly around a huge teardrop belly that sagged over his waistline. His wavy black hair snaked over his shoulders, down front and back, and a blue bandana looped around his forehead. As the truck backed away, he took a long pull from one of the sacks, and it was then that I recognized him. For it was in this one particular gesture, that of bottle being upturned, held, and returned, that I knew my uncle, the famous Indian artist, Johnson L. Freebird.
That's Eddie Chukalate reading from his collection, Cheyenne Madonna. And Eddie, you were born in 1972. You grew up in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and that makes you a contemporary of your protagonist, Jordan Coolwater. He's an artist, you're a writer, but how much of these stories are autobiographical?
I'd say about half of them. And autobiographical in the sense, well, they start off based on real events, then I throw some other stuff in that never happened, so it's really a mixture. It's totally fiction, actually.
Well, tell me what your life was like in the 70s in Muskogee.
In the 70s in Muskogee, during the summers, I did live with my grandparents outside of town, but mainly we lived in town. I lived close enough to my school where I could walk to school, which was three or four blocks. But the best thing about that was in second grade, there was a new library. The Muskogee Public Library was right by my school. So on the way home, I would stop in every day, and I wouldn't go home till it got dark. And the librarians got to know me. They knew me, and that was the best thing about it. And it was still is a real nice library there for the size of the town. The town's about 40,000, and it's the hub of the Eastern Oklahoma District Library System. And it was two stories with a lot. The lower level was children's books, and the upstairs was supposed to be adult. But I had read nearly all of the books in the children's section, and they let me actually go upstairs to the adult section, which I thought was a big deal for a second grader. But, I can still remember that just like it was yesterday.
Did you know any writers growing up?
Did I know any? Let's see. No, not really. I read the newspaper a lot. And I read a lot of Art Buchwald and Mike Royko, newspaper columnists. Read the newspaper religiously.
Do you remember at what point in your life it occurred to you that you could be a writer? That's something you could do?
I never thought out of it as an occupation or anything, but I do remember this, that and I don't remember writing it, but my grandmother dug a story I wrote out of our memory album or picture box one time, and I wrote a story when I was only like 5 years old, and it had a beginning, a middle, and an end about this hillbilly who grates the bottles of Mountain Dew soda. There used to be a hillbilly on those bottles, and somehow I got it into my mind where I'd write about him, and in my story he ran away from home, and everyone was worried and looked for him, and they found him, and they lived happily ever after. But that was only when I was like five, and I remember when I was seven or eight, I actually wrote a play. So I was doing this writing when I was real little, and I was always reading books, too.
So it was just something that just sort of sprang forth from you.
Yeah, pretty much. Both of my grandparents were preachers, so obviously they had a knack for words. So I like to think that I got some of that from them.
One of the interesting things in your stories, as I mentioned before, Jordan Coolwater is an artist, and he has artists in his family, obviously. He went to school with other artists. And one of the things that we kind of see him struggle with is that he is pigeonholed, in a sense. If he wants to make something that shows a picture of his wife and child, he also changes it so that they're in a birch bark canoe or they're on the Trail of Tears. And he tried at one point to make a dolphin, a carving of a dolphin, but he couldn't sell it because it didn't have a feather on it. Is that something that you see people artists and writers in American Indian communities struggling with, that they almost need to have an American Indian branding to be able to do what they want to do?
It's a twofold situation. I went to the Institute of American Indian Art, where this subject came up almost daily. It's almost to the point where, say you're a Chippewa and you want to do some traditional scenes, you know, birch bark canoes or baskets or whatever. Typically, they don't sell as well as a plains warrior on a galloping stallion spearing a buffalo, or some scenes like that. So a guy might do a lot of those quick, easy sellers to be able to bankroll some money and do what he considers more important or more traditional work. So it can go both ways. I mean, you can complain about it, but when it comes time to make some money, then you'll trot out your well-worn favorites, and we might be working on your masterpiece in the background. They call it putting a feather on the Mona Lisa.
Your stories tell about a lot of people surrounding your hero, and also they tell about him. And one of the themes that keeps coming back again and again is alcoholism. His father was an alcoholic. Many of his uncles are alcoholics. He struggles with alcoholism. And the stories are very nuanced, and they read as very real. But do you have any kind of a concern about perpetuating a stereotype?
No, not really, because when I set out to write this book, I knew it was going to be, some would pigeonhole it as Native American literature, but I was wanting, if you read the book, it's more about a family or more about a person. The people are Indian because he's Indian. I mean, his dad's Indian, his family's Indian. So, does that make it Indian art or Indian literature? So, and some of that stuff, my dad, he was an alcoholic. He died from alcoholism. So I wasn't going to change it just because someone might see it as stereotypical.
Because it's true.
Yeah, and a lot of artists or writers, no matter their race or nationality, are drinkers.
The book in many ways reads like a novel. You have a character that you follow throughout, and it comes together beautifully, threads from the first story to the last story. Why did you decide to publish it as a collection of short stories as opposed to publishing it as a novel?
Well, originally I had some of these stories in a novel, more of a novel form, but to me it just wasn't working. And I think I'm more of a short story writer anyway, so I didn't see any reason to try to make it something that it wasn't. And I just spent a year or two trying to make it into a novel, and just gave it up and just put them back in short story form.
My guest right now is Eddie Chukalate. He is the author of Cheyenne Madonna, a collection of short stories. He'll be reading tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 o'clock. We're going to talk more about American Indian literature in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, my guest is Eddie Chukalate. He's the author of a new collection of short stories called Cheyenne Madonna. He is also a student at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop and also a recipient of the O. Henry Prize in 2007 for one of the stories that appears in the book. And we're also going to broaden the conversation right now. We're going to talk about American Indian literature in a more general sense. My guests joining me now are Philip Round. He's a professor of English and American Indian and Native Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of Removable Type, Histories of the Book in Indian Country, 1663 to 1880. And James Kopic, he's a poet, and he also teaches in the Department of English and the American Indian Studies program at Iowa State University. Phil, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Jim, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, I want to start with you right now because I want to go back, way back through time, to some of the earliest American Indian literature, which was produced by the Mayans. What kinds of written work did they have?
Well, they had really all the same sorts of written work that we do. Here we are in the wake of Thanksgiving. There are a lot of sort of cultural assertions that we make about indigenous people in America, and one of them is when the Spanish arrived in South America, they found a couple of friendly sort of naked heathens on the beaches to greet them and not much else. nothing could really be farther from the truth. There were large cities with arts and sciences, multi-story buildings, market economies, plumbing, and literature. Thousands and thousands of volumes of history, legend, myth, science, astronomy, astrology, all of these things. But the thing is, most of those disappeared along the way, so we don't talk about them much. The way they disappeared were the conquistadors and the missionaries coming through in what's been called the American Holocaust and burning all of the books they found of indigenous people. We have about four volumes left of Mayan writing. Some of it is almanac, some of it is astronomy, some of it is mapping. We have a great creation story left from a document called the Popol Vuh. And that's really about it. But we know that it did exist. We know that it was there. The Spanish wrote about it, talked about it.
And it sounds like it was extremely sophisticated.
It was. And not only were the Mayans sophisticated and the Aztecs and the people who had written languages, but even around here in Iowa, where the Plains Indians had a mostly oral tradition, they had a very sophisticated mythology, a very sophisticated way of talking to each other about who are we as human beings? How did we come to be here? What are our obligations? What are our stories? And where are we in these stories? It's all been in place for a very long time. A mistake people make is thinking that American Indian literature started in 1969 when Mamadé won the Pulitzer. But really, it's been around as long as there have been people in this part of the world.
A lot of that literature, the oral tradition, was under siege, though. When the European settlers came to this country, a lot of that tradition disappeared.
Right. Not only were there book burnings, there was a concentrated movement to take away culture and language from American Indians for a very long time. People were forced into boarding schools growing up, so that instead of growing up with tribal ways of knowing and being and a tribal education, which involved being told all of these stories until they become part of you, people were forced to go to English language schools and to read English language texts. And that's how a lot of the reading and writing, a lot of the early American Indian literature began, the stuff that we get from the late 19th century, from the early 20th century. It came out of that movement to make Indians assimilate, to make them more European, to make them more white.
Phil, you have researched some of the early American Indian voices that came about after the European settlers swept the nation. What kinds of remnants and what kinds of things do you find from... And actually, you mentioned one being as early as 1772.
Yeah, the first book published by an American Indian writer in English is Samson Occam's sermon in the 1772. It was for the execution of a fellow Mohegan native man who had committed a murder. And sermons were real popular literature amongst the Anglo-Americans in those days. You could sell a sermon, especially an execution sermon, like hotcakes. And nothing was more sensational than an American Indian missionary preaching to another American Indian and talking, in fact, about alcoholism. The murder was committed under circumstances in which alcohol was involved. And so Occam took that opportunity to write a little bit of a broader thing than maybe his Anglo-American missionary fathers, if you will, thought he would. And he took the opportunity to really embrace the idea not only of a Christian assimilation that Jim was talking about, but also to embrace the idea of being an Indian and being proud of it. And so at a certain point in the sermon, which was published, he turns and exhorts his fellow brethren, he calls them, and talks about we Indians of this United States. Well, it was not the United States yet. We Indians of America. And he would go on throughout his career. That book went through 13 editions on through the 19th century, one of the best-selling books of that period. And he went on throughout his career. He lived to the 1790s talking about we Indians of America. He was one of the early writers as well as leaders who thought of an intertribal idea of American Indian identity that could maybe push back against some of the assimilation Jim talked about. And writing was one way that he found would be a very effective way of communicating that and doing that.
Did others follow his lead at that time?
Oh, yes. He was in school Eddie was talking about going by the Muskogee Public Library on the way home. And Occam was a kid like that, too, who went to school partly for the Christian education that all schools had at the time, but also partly because he had a love of books and words. And he was trying to make this transition from a largely verbal tradition in Mohegan society into this combination Mohegan Anglo-American society. And so he took with him a real love of books, and he was surrounded by other American Indian scholars at that school, a famous war leader up in Mohawk country. His name's going to escape me real quick here, but people like Hendrik Appelmott and other leaders in the early period all came out of these early schools, and they went back into their tribal communities and took literacy with them, not as a gesture toward assimilation, but as a gesture toward empowerment for this new kind of culture they were finding themselves in.
At the same time, though, there were a lot of portraits of American Indians being painted or being written by European settlers as well. Was there a conflict between these images that were being created?
Completely. One of the fascinating books out there is written in 1880 by a Tuscarora leader, and it's called Legends of the Iroquois. But in the beginning of that book, the author, Elias Johnson, says, "What? Another book about Indians," as though his audience would be sick to death of this subject. And he's kind of making a joke there, because the problem Indian authors had, as Eddie was alluding to even today, and they had it in the 18th and 19th century, was going against this huge tide of either romantic representations of Native people or savage representations of them. The most popular play in America before the Civil War was Metamora, all about an evil Indian chief played by an Irish actor, Edwin Forrest, who died night after night after having ravaged a white community. So Indian authors found themselves constantly battling this give and take of romantic, savage, and then homespun versions of themselves.
Eddie, growing up in an American Indian community, was there American Indian literature available to you? Was that something that people in your community read or talked about?
I wouldn't say they sat around and talked about it, but it was available. I mean, like I said, Muskogee had a great, or does have a great, library system. And but I'd like to touch on one thing. Back in the 70s, when you were asking about growing up in Muskogee, it was quite the common term. You know, Muskogee was and still is a racially diverse community, whites, Indians, and blacks, and now they're Asian, more Asians and Hispanics. But back when I was growing up there, it was mainly blacks, whites, and Indians. And quite the common term you'd hear at school was my dad or my folks say I'm part Indian, but we don't claim it. Okay? And I put a little part in my book in there where I say I'm part white, but I don't claim it. Kind of a little gig back at that. But I noticed that back in the 70s or whatever, when people were going around saying, you know, I'm part Indian, but we don't claim it. But they sure do now, because if they can prove so much blood, they get free medical care and all this other stuff. And plus, there's this this wave of pan-Indianism where everyone's proud to be Indian now. But back in the 70s, if you were maybe an 8th or 16th, people went around saying we don't claim it. But now they claim it.
There are people now who claim Indian heritage who barely have Indian heritage. I remember hearing Sherman Alexie speak one night, and he was talking about how many people walk up to him and say, I'm part Cherokee. And he says, yeah, you, me, everyone else as well. How do people who are from that culture actually feel about the fact that so many people want to claim a little piece of it now?
Well, it's a kind of a tricky situation. I worked for the I'm Cherokee. My grandfather was full blood. My dad was half, so I'm a quarter Cherokee, and then I'm Creek also. But I worked for the Cherokee Nation a few years ago, and our chief now is Chadwick Smith, Chad Smith, and apparently his philosophy is to let he's lowered the blood quantum, and to let I mean, the people, if you look at them, you'd think they were white, but they do, you know, they can prove X amount of blood, so they can qualify for vehicle tags, lower insurance, medical care, and all this stuff. And the chief's philosophy on that is the more people he lets into the tribe, the more federal money the tribe gets. So it's like a two-way street. Not all tribes do that, but the Cherokees are. That's why their numbers are so high. But if they were to chop that blood quantum off at, say, at least half, I'd say the membership would decrease by half.
I want to go back to the early part of the 20th century, and Jim, we'll go to you first. Can you give us examples of some of the voices that were emerging in American Indian literature there?
I can. Probably the best known writer among American Indians in the beginning of the 20th century was Zitkala Saw, who wrote a great essay for The Atlantic in 1902 called Why I Am a Pagan. That talked about Indian-ness, that talked about identity. There's a lot of American Indian literature coming into the early 19th century. One of the most interesting bits of early 19th century American Indian literature is the balance between the oral culture and the literary culture. One example of this is 1932. Black Elk, who was a Sioux in chief, talked about his life orally. His son Ben Black Elk translated it into English, and a guy named John Neihardt wrote it down, and that became one of the best-selling American Indian books of that era.
Phil, do you have a few other examples that you can add to that?
Yeah. One thing that happened a little bit earlier on than even the 20th century is in the 1880s. This is the beginning of something called the Dawes Act in American Indian history, where the government basically forcibly separated Indian tribally owned land into individual parcels. But they also forced boarding school education on a lot of kids. And a lot of the kids who went through that also came out the other side as literate members of community who, like Eddie's protagonist in his collection, are very concerned about where they fit in everywhere. But the literature they produced is fabulous stuff. And I would include someone like the Paiute writer Sarah Winnemucca Hopkins, whose life among the Paiute is a fascinating story of trying to navigate that world as well as just try to get tribal lands back during the 1880s. Someone like Darcy McNichol from the 1930s and 40s who again, up in Montana, experienced a similar sort of a transference of cultural experience. He wrote a lot of good. The Surrounded is a great work that he wrote. So there's a lot more literature out there, I think, than people know about, and we're trying to get some of that word out today.
Right. Well, people probably still think of Last of the Mohicans as
yes.
American Indian literature from that time period. And we're going to talk about more recent works of American Indian authors as well. And we'd love to have you join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'd love to hear about the authors that have touched your life, that have moved you, that you turn to time and time again. 866-780-9100 at our IPR Talk on Twitter, or our email address talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Phil, was there a point in the 20th century where it became inappropriate for someone who wasn't of an American Indian background to write American Indian literature?
Well, I mean, that's still a problem today, but I would say that Jim mentioned Scott Mamaday's 1969 Pulitzer Prize, and that comes on the heels and at the beginning of something called the American Indian Movement or the Red Power Movement in broader cultural terms. So after that period in the 1970s, it was a lot tougher to that actor I talked about in the 19th century pass yourself off as an American Indian. But still, as Eddie pointed out, it's still an ongoing conversation in Indian country about who exactly is representing what in literature or art or music even.
Well, I think that people are very familiar with Mamaday's name, and they see quotes from him all over the place. But Jim, tell me more about his writing for people who aren't familiar with it.
Well, Mamaday was the child of an artist and a paper and a painter, an artist. He wrote a lot of books. The Housemaid of Dawn The Way to Rainy Mountain, or the most famous, Angle of Geese, The Gourd Dancer. At least a dozen books came out. He was a playwright as well. He wrote a lot of autobiographical sorts of things. Some of it was really his life. Some of it was, as was described earlier, about half from actual events. Came out as a sort of a writer of identity. People read Mamadeh to get a glimpse into the American Indian world in that period of time, in the 60s and during the times he was growing up, the 40s, the 50s. He really brought out American Indian life in a way that a lot of other people hadn't. Some American Indian writers are American Indian writers in the way William Carlos Williams is a Latino writer. You know, it's blood quantum. But Mamadeh was the beginning of a movement of writers who really dug into what it means to be Indian, what it means to have that identity, and what sorts of things Indians are thinking about, what sort of ways they think about them.
We're talking about American Indian literature, and you're welcome to join our conversation. My guests right now are James Coppock. He's a poet, and he teaches at Iowa State University. Philip Round, a professor of English and American Indian and Native Studies at the University of Iowa. And Eddie Chukalate, who's the author of the collection of short stories, Cheyenne Madonna. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about American Indian literature. My guests right now are Eddie Chukalate. He's the author of a new collection of short stories called Cheyenne Madonna. The book was just released in September, and he'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore tonight in Iowa City at 7 o'clock. My guests are also Philip Round, a professor of English and American Indian and Native Studies at the University of Iowa, and James Coppock, who's a poet, and he also teaches in the Department of English and the American Indian Studies program at Iowa State University. And we'd love to hear from you as well. We're going to talk about American Indian literature in the modern era from the 1960s on, and we'd love to hear about the authors that you feel have been the most influential. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Susan is on the line from Cascade. Hello, Susan.
Hi, I wanted to get some input from your guest regarding the contributions made by Ray Youngbear. This is an Iowa angle because he is a member of the Meskwaki tribe from Tama, Iowa. They call themselves the people of the Red Earth, and they have significant ties to this land and spiritually, physically, and even economically in the modern day, and he's written a lot about that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Susan, thank you so much for your call. And Jim, why don't I give you the first chance? Ray Youngbear, of course, has written many books, including many volumes of poetry. What do you feel his place is in this genre?
I'm glad you gave me that chance. Ray Youngbear is one of my favorites. He's not only a poet, but also a novelist. And I guess what we would have to call a spoken word artist. Ray is from Tama. He's Meskwaki. And he's been writing since he was a teenager. He began writing by thinking in Meskwaki and then translating it into English. As he moved on into his career, he started writing more in English, but he used a lot of Meskwaki oratory, a lot of Meskwaki styles, craft elements. And this comes out especially if you ever have the chance to see him live. You'll see singing hand drums, Meskwaki songs with English translations. It's really a great view of how American Indians tell stories of the oral tradition at its finest.
Well, and he's also been involved with trying to preserve the Meskwaki language. Is that a role that many American Indian authors of today find themselves in, is not just writers, but also they have to become advocates for their culture?
I think that really falls on every writer, American Indian or not, to be maybe not a conservator of language, but at least someone who's deeply invested in seeing that language keeps its sort of majesty and beauty. Young Bear is involved in that with the Meskwaki language. There are a lot of people who are doing that with Lakota, who are to the northwest of us. There are people doing that in quite a few Native American languages, and more as time goes on, you see these cultural renewals happening. It's really a great thing to see.
Phil, do you have something to add there?
Yeah, two of my favorite Native poets right now, or at least those who work in both English and their in a native language, Lucy Tapahanso, a Diné poet from out west, and also Ophelia Zepeda, who's a Tohono O'odham speaker and a writer. She's also a linguist, and those are two of the largest spoken languages in America today that are native languages. I think 150,000 people speak Navajo still. And you get a real flavor, even as a non-native speaker of those languages, in the poetry of those two poets, because they'll often do facing page translations or works of poetry that, as Jim said, sort of trade back and forth, not only with the language, but the rhythms and the ceremonial styles, if you will, and so any reader, even from outside those communities, can really get a new perspective on his or her own language, as well as hearing the native language in those kinds of works.
Eddie, do you speak a Native American Indian language?
I don't speak it, but I know a lot of words, and I can understand a lot of it. Creek. I was raised more Creek than Cherokee.
How do you feel about the fact that you grew up as part of this culture, but that's something that wasn't a part of your upbringing, to learn the language?
Well, I was kind of like a product of, I think someone before mentioned about my grandmother went to a, I don't know if you'd call it a boarding school, but it was a U.S. government-run school where speaking your native language was frowned upon and even punished by. So even though she spoke it and understood it, she didn't speak it around us. So therefore, how am I going to pick up on it if there's no one speaking it around the house? And the reason why they weren't was because of this assimilation bull. But I was wanting to add another poet to the guys you guys were talking about, like Lucy and Ray Youngbear. There's a guy up in Minnesota, Jim Northrup, who does a lot of he's Chippewa, and he's a poet and an activist and a storyteller, and he uses a lot of humor in his kind of like sly, subtle humor in his works. He's kind of a regional guy, I think, should be mentioned.
Well, and Jim Kopic also is a poet in his own right, and his most recent book is Reliquary, which was published last January. Poetry does seem to be a strong part of this genre. Phil, why do you think there are so many poets who write in American Indian literature?
Well, when you look back at what Native writers have been saying for about two centuries about their transition onto the printed page or the written page, all of them, from going back to Samson Ockham to people like Ophelia Zepeda today, will tell you that it's a very awkward transition in terms of genre, because things that are sung, spoken, and performed in Native societies don't really make it onto a two-dimensional surface that well. And a lot of people, I think of Leslie Silco, for example, Laguna Pueblo novelist, who also breaks her narrative on the page into poem-like structures. Ray Younger does this as well. I think to break free of some of those kind of European genre distinctions that don't hold in different Native communities.
We have Amy on the line from Bettendorf. She called 866-780-9100. Hi, Amy. What would you like to talk about?
I just wondered if one of your guests would speak a little bit about James Welch, who wrote Fool's Crow and Winter in the Blood, because he's one of my favorite authors.
All right. Well, I'm absolutely sure they will. And so, Phil, I'll let you start this time, because I know Jim would like to as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah, one of my favorite authors. In fact, I was backstage at an event like this about 5 years ago with Gordon Henry, Ojibwe writer, and Charles Redcorn. And we didn't know each other, so we're trying to find some common ground. And we found common ground in James Welch's book of poetry, Writing the Earth Boy 40. All of us in our different lives across the country had been transformed by that book. And I just think James Welch is one of the greats.
And how about you, Jim? Do you have something you'd like to add?
I think he's one of the greats, too. He's a novelist, a nonfiction writer, a poet, from the Northwest, Blackfeet and Grovan. And Actually, his cousin, who grew up with him, is a literary critic who lives in Ames, named Sidner Larson. So there's an Iowa connection there, too.
All right, terrific. We'd love to hear from you with your suggestions for American Indian authors, 866-780-9100. But let's talk about some of the other greats that are publishing right now. Phil?
Well, an author I like a lot because she also is one of these people who bends genres and works in a lot of different areas is Leanne Howe, a Choctaw writer who actually teaches at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana right now. And she's done everything from film to a radio show called Indian Radio Days back in the 90s. And she has a really good book called Shell Shaker out there about Choctaw life in the 20th and in the 18th centuries. It flashes back and forth. Really good book.
And how about you, Jim?
My absolute hero as a poet, a playwright, and maybe even just as a person is Sherman Alexie, who I guess I'd like to at some point maybe hear Phil talk about this idea too. He's in between Indian and white culture. He grew up on a reservation. When he got into high school, he opened up a math book and was looking at the names that were written on the cover of people who had the book before. He saw his mom's book from when she was a high schooler. He saw his mom's name. And so he realized he wouldn't get a very good education on the reservation where he was. He went out to a town called Reardon, got himself a white education. Everything he writes is about being trapped between cultures or being in one culture and dealing with another culture. And he's done this in poems. He's done this in film. He's done this in novels.
He really broke through onto the American consciousness with the movie Smoke Signals.
Right. Yeah, in 1997. It was the first big movie, the first well-funded movie that was made by Indian. Chris Eyre was the producer-director that was made by Indians, using actual Indians to act it, and told a real Indian story. And he got huge critical acclaim for that.
And Phil, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think that, Eddie was talking about how it's a question whether your story is as an American Indian writer about people or about Indians. And I think Sherman's Alexie's books are like that. And he's also got that great sense of humor, again, that Eddie brought up that we sometimes forget about. But not with Sherman Alexie. I know that my friend Delphine Redshirt, a Lakota writer, once told me a story that someone in the audience at a reading raised his hand and said, "What's your relationship to the oral tradition?" And Sherman Alexie said, "I type real slow." And so I think that kind of sums up where he stands on a lot of things.
Eddie, who are you reading?
Right now, I'm reading a lot of memoirs because I plan to write a memoir. And I picked out a few of the what I consider some of the best around. Chris Offit has written two great ones. Tobias Wolff has written two great ones. And as far as Native Americans, I was really influenced by, The Housemaid of Dawn. Not only him and Louise Erdrich, not only are these two of the greatest American Indian writers, but two of the greatest writers, period, I think, as far as stylistically. I mean, reading both of their work, especially The Way to Rainy Mountain and some of Louise's, all of Louise's work. It's something like reading poetry in prose form. It's just spectacular, regardless of race or nationality. That's Mamadé and Erdrich, I think.
Well, and Erdrich may be the most high-profile American Indian writer today. I certainly see her work on bestseller lists, and I hear about her most often. I believe she lives in the Twin Cities area still. Ron is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hello, Ron.
Yes, hi. First of all, I want to compliment the panel for agreeing that Sherman Alexie is an amazing writer. Second of all, my question is, what is the overall feeling of non-Native American writers writing about the Native American condition or life on the reservation? I was thinking of Ian Fraser's On the Res. Is that viewed as an intrusion into the genre, or is it a welcome part of the canon to get that outside viewpoint? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Ron. Why don't I give you the first opportunity to respond to that, Eddie?
I wouldn't think it'd be much of an intrusion because I'm sure he got I haven't read the book, but I'm sure he got some sort of permission to do what he did, and I'm sure any kind of ceremony he probably wasn't – I wouldn't say welcome at any kind of sacred ceremonies or secret ceremonies. He might have been welcome to watch but not to report on or write about. So anything that he gets on the page has probably been approved, I'd say. But it's welcome as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, Jim, can you respond to that as well?
Yeah, I haven't read Frazier's book either, but in more general terms, reservations are out there in the world, and we come into contact with them. We experience them. They're fair game for anyone to write about. What matters, I think, is the treatment. Are you appropriating Indian culture in ways that are respectful, or are you latching onto it for other reasons? And there are writers that fall on either side of this divide. Hollywood is a great example, especially of American Indian history. Movies like Dances with Wolves that grab onto that Last of the Mohicans tradition of the white guy out Indianing the Indians. Avatar came out that in some way has to do with appropriating American Indian history last year. And there are some that are really respectful treatments. It just sort of depends on who's doing the writing and what their real goals are and what sorts of dialogue they enter into.
I think we have time for one last call. Dean is on the line from Iowa City. Hello, Dean.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm a little surprised no one's mentioned Joy Harjo yet, who's a wonderful poet who, getting back to poetry in the oral tradition and why some Native American writers choose poetry. And she's actually more, well, she writes critically and poems. But her poem, The Woman Who Fell from the Sky, takes an old oral tradition and relates it to modern day. It's about an alcoholic woman and a bad mom and how she falls from the sky and kind of gets reborn. And I think Harjo is great at taking those old stories and putting them into a context that many of us can understand. She incidentally tried to join the Iowa Writers Workshop in the 70s when it was probably just earning its reputation and was told her writing was too Indian. And ended up not being here and kind of had a chip on her shoulder about that ever since. I was fortunate to study with Professor Linda Bolton in the English department at the University of Iowa, who's actually more of a philosophy teacher and writes about ethics, but she studied under N. Scott Mamaday in Arizona and was a Marmon Silko.
But, Dean, thank you so much.
Harjo's a great one.
All right, well, that's a wonderful recommendation. And Phil, do we have a correction about Harjo's role in the
I think she did have some struggles here. She's a friend of mine. She's also Creek, but I believe that she got her MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop.
Okay, well, good, and I'm glad that isn't true. So Eddie, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Phil and Jim, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Eddie Chukalate is the author of the new collection, Cheyenne Madonna. He'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock in Iowa City. My other guests were Philip Round of the University of Iowa. He's also the author of Removable Type, Histories of the Book in Indian Country. And Jim Kopic of Iowa State University, author of Reliquary and other books. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Russell Mansky in Ames. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Charity Nebbe.